Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Race IndyCar podcast. After a preview episode where we tried to give you every possible scenario how Joseph Newgarden might not win both of the races, he proved us wrong and doubled up in Iowa. So get your broom out. Joseph Newgarden's going for a sweep. He's achieved some quite impressive feats over the course of this weekend. It'll probably take us quite a while to go through all of the numbers. On this week's show, we'll wrap up some of those numbers and talk about how Joseph was able to win those two races. We'll also look at how his rivals fared. We'll talk about Alex Palou and how his comeback in race two may have just saved his season. We'll also talk about some of the more dark horse kind of candidates across the course of the weekend, and we'll talk about the end of race two, which has kind of thrown up a little bit of controversy, but not as much as controversy as I might have expected. JL Hildebrand's alongside me. How are you doing, JL?
Yeah, good, man. Definitely plenty to get into, depending on kind of how deep we want to get, I think. But yeah, definitely excited to break down what was ultimately just a great weekend of racing in the IndyCar series.
It's always hard to do a pod after the doubleheader, isn't it? Because you've just got so much to get into. I think this is probably actually the first time we've ever recorded on a Sunday night, which is interesting, I guess, in the sense that normally we do it on Monday when we've had a chance to kind of go through some more of the data and really kind of digest and watch back the race if we need to. But I guess there's just so much to get into that we're just not going to be able to go that deep into the two races. But we can definitely pick out some of the key storylines and try and give the listeners an entertaining pod. So I just wanted to run through a few of Joseph's numbers for people who maybe haven't kind of kept in touch with all of those. So he's won 8 of the last 10 oval races in IndyCar now, which is an absolutely staggering number. He's also joined a club of AJ Foyt and Alan Cecina as the only drivers to win 5 oval races in a row since, I think the records go back to 1956. That was pretty impressive. And the day before, he joined a group of 4 with Nigel Mansell included in that group, who've won 4 in a row. So even across the course of the two races, he was breaking records and joining elite clubs. JR, I know obviously Joseph's a big mate of yours and you've got a lot of respect for him, and we're his teammate at one point as well. I guess the thing I kind of want to get into with you, and what I hope you can provide some pretty cool background on, is just, you know, Joseph has got 2 incredible teammates, as we saw in qualifying and across the two races, in Will Power and Scott McLaughlin, who have access to his data. And we also know how much data kind of flies around the paddock these days, and even just how much like video all of the drivers can watch. So I guess every year the drivers are getting, well, as long as there's a doubleheader, they're getting 500 laps of onboard that they can watch from Joseph's car if they really want to. And then his teammates are kind of crunching all that data inside the team. And Joseph even admitted to opening his playbook to Scott McLaughlin and teaching him some things about Iowa in the build-up to the weekend as well, to try and help him. And yet still he turns up and manages to blow the field away in both races. It took him 121 laps to get to the front in the first race, but it only took him 31 laps in the second race from 7th on the grid when he was 3rd on the grid in the first race. So just an incredible level of performance that I think is kind of underappreciated, because people expect Joseph to turn up at Iowa and do such a great job. But what do you make of that whole thing, JR? Just the level that Joseph must be at to kind of have all of that kind of data exposed to everybody else, and yet still he's able to come and do the same thing he's done in previous years here.
Yeah, I guess I think to kind of keep it a little bit more concise, I think it comes down to a combination of 2 things. One is something that we've talked about kind of at length before. We talked about this definitely in the pre-race pod, which is just his adaptability and his patience getting through traffic. I mean, they were all talking about it, that he gets through traffic better I think that that really just comes down to you get through traffic better by your sort of process of decision making in terms of analyzing the traffic that's ahead of you, the cars that are ahead of you, whether they're for position or on or not, like you're catching lap cars or they're in and out of the where they're at in their stint relative to where you're at in your stint. There's a lot of variables that go into that. He kind of has this ability to crunch all of that very quickly, have an innate feel for what's happening around him, where the cars in front of him are operating. And I think just that little bit of, well, and I guess as a part of that, it's like, he doesn't go into the corner super committed to one lane or another. He's not like forcing it. You know, I mentioned that in the pre-race. It was something that I've noticed about his races at Iowa over the last few years, is just this, like, you can tell he's kind of rolling out of the throttle, going into the corner, bending in at a rate that he can kind of wait for the car in front of him to pick a lane and then just make, basically, it's almost a little bit defensive when you, and especially in races like this, and in race two, we saw this in much more exaggerated fashion, just cars really going off by the end of a stint, that just not having to, he just doesn't wedge himself in a jam behind the cars in front of him, basically. And so that to me is like one piece of this. The other piece of it is that I think he just really knows what he needs from the car. And that to me was kind of exposed in race one. Like, he was kind of nowhere in the first stint and got a couple of change, you know, got a wing change in that first pit stop, and suddenly the car was completely alive. Like, he's managed to kind of figure out, and that they obviously just carried what they found from race one into race two, which I think is a big part. They just started off race two with that car right in the window. And that happens over a number of years, over various test days, over having some weekends at these kinds of tracks where it isn't quite perfect. Like, you've gone from having a car that you really thought you could do whatever you needed to with, to not quite having it. So it's kind of like, sometimes that's a good reminder of what you really do need when you don't have it. And so I think those are the two things, maybe just more broadly, that make Joseph the guy on ovals right now. Like, I was thinking a little bit ahead of the podcast about going into, like, what are the odds that he just sweeps the oval races this year, going to Gateway later on in the year? And it's kind of like, there's not somebody else besides him that you'd say, like, if you just asked me who I think's going to win at Gateway, it's Newgarden. Like, it's not to say that he's the only, Pato definitely stands out as a driver that can go do that. But at these places, you really do need the car to work for you. You need it to be able to do all of the, at Iowa in particular, you need it to be able to do all of the different things. It can't just work really well on the high line or the low line. You need it to work in both places. You need to kind of know ahead of time the feeling that you need from the car to get it to do that. And so I think it's just that combination of those two things for Joseph. He knows what he's got and he knows what he needs. Like, he's able to quickly identify both of those things during these weekends. And then once he's got that, he's just got a little bit of a leg up on kind of everybody else, it seems like. And I think that's where I would at least compare him still to Scott and Will, that, you know, part of him being a little better than those guys over the duration of a race, part of that might be that he just really knows what he needs from the car. And so he's got a few little tweaks in there that are kind of just for him. But the other piece of it certainly is that he's still able to extract more out of that, particularly when you get into, you know, a race like either of these races where you were there wasn't a lot of fuel saving going on. You know, it was basically the pit stops was dictated by tires, not fuel. So you're just kind of getting as much out of as you can every stint until the tires are totally smoked and you're inside your window. And it was just, it, it was, to use the word a clinic is probably overused in this kind of situation, but it really is something worth studying, kind of. Like, it's not just a clinic in the fact that he went and buried everybody for 2 days in a row, but really just how he's able to get it done is something that we kind of still just don't, in as a complete package, something that we haven't seen from anybody else in this like era and this type of racing at these tracks.
When you see someone perform that way in any sport, really, I guess you're always looking for that one kind of golden bullet to explain why they've been able to outperform their rivals. But I totally agree with you that it's much more complicated than that with Joseph at Iowa. And I'm really happy with where you kind of fell there and your insight, because I think you've probably picked out definitely the two key components of why Newgarden's so good here. I think the base of the Penske car is, you know, awesome, as we've seen from the performances of his rivals, but also that ability to pick out traffic and work out where he's going to go high and low. I guess factored into the car kind of discussion, you spoke about him being able to kind of know what adjustments are needed, and I found that one of the quite interesting aspects of the double header, because obviously at the end of the first race you usually get a host of drivers who feel like they've learned something across the course of that race, that they're able to make improvements and find that kind of special sauce for the next race, for the Sunday. But I guess what usually happens is you kind of get a lot of drivers making small improvements, and I guess high tide raises all boats kind of situation. But I quite enjoyed speaking to Luke Mason, Joseph Newgarden's engineer, on Sunday morning, and he was kind of talking about how the fact that they have to impound the cars after qualifying for the first race makes a big difference to race two, in terms of there's just certain things that they can do there that they just don't have to do obviously when they're trying to prepare for qualifying as well. So there is a little bit of wiggle room in terms of the setup and what you can do with the car between races that does kind of make a difference. But even so, we saw higher temperatures in race two, and we still saw Joseph able to kind of keep ahead of the conditions and just be able to judge that with the right car changes, or have the for want of a better phrase, the balls to not change the car, because that's what they did on the first stop, was they called for no changes on that first pit stop after, you know, predictably he'd moved to the front, so his car was obviously good. But the fact that they'd, you know, stood firm there and made the decision not to make any changes, despite, you know, trying to anticipate what the track's going to do, is a big deal. Before we move on, Joe, I wanted to go to race one quickly, because I guess the race in itself was relatively straightforward once Joseph got to the front. Scott McLaughlin was his main rival. It looked like there was maybe a moment towards the end where Joseph was catching traffic that Scott would be able to zero in and maybe go for a move, or at least almost did go for the move. But there was just enough traffic there that it kind of worked in Joseph's favour a little bit, and he was able to pull back out again. I think it was clear that Joseph had the better car of the two and the better kind of ability to move through traffic. But what we did see at the end of the race was Joseph extremely frustrated. Immediately after he got out of the car, he was swearing when he was talking to Scott McLaughlin, who was the first person that kind of approached him after the race win there. And he was angry with some of the drivers, how they'd raced him. It's not the first time blue flags and that kind of whole situation has come up in IndyCar this year, going back to Road America and Benjamin Pedersen being the kind of most talked about example. But I guess I'm kind of interested in your take on, you know, how much of this you saw from the broadcast, JR. But, you know, Joseph, very, very upset after the race. He said if people race him like that, he's going to fence them, and was quite, quite abrupt and pretty flat out about how he felt about how certain people were racing him. I think Kyle Kirkwood was one of the kind of maybe contenders, because he was racing him quite hard inside the last 20 laps, and Kyle unlapped himself, which Joseph admitted was within the rules. And Newgarden and Scott McLaughlin, who was also criticising the traffic, didn't name any names. So I know Kirkwood, Pillow, and Balukas were a couple of people that Newgarden came across over the towards the end of the race there. But I was just interested in your thoughts on what you saw on the broadcast and how much of this you felt was you know, people deliberately, or maybe not deliberately, but people racing Newgarden badly or unfairly as a leader, and how much of it is just kind of general short track racing stuff that kind of happens, where we do see this kind of thing happen, and maybe it wasn't as bad as Joseph made out to be.
I guess my feeling about it not having, all I have to work with is having watched the broadcast. So there could certainly be some things that I just didn't see. I mean, it'd be interesting to see maybe some onboard from the last, 15 or 20 laps or something. But I guess my feeling generally here is, well, there's a couple of things just to give some context. One is that, obviously, as everybody knows, this is not context that anybody needs, is that it is allowed. And so I guess I think that it's probably just these guys basically racing everybody as if it's for position in essence. And I've been super frustrated by that, having run up front at some of these short oval, these short tracks like that and been irritated by the exact same thing. And it's kind of like until the general agreement that drivers have or the rules change, it's sort of just what you're going to get. And particularly in these situations where you're lapping up through like inside the top 10, I guess. So yeah, something that I definitely noticed in race two was, or that you could definitely notice just watching the broadcast, was basically how badly guys were falling off and how hard of a time they were having just basically keeping the car on the straight and narrow by the end of a stint. And so I think because the weather was a little warmer and the track conditions were a little worse, maybe in race two, there was at least on the broadcast, there was a little more of that going on. But to be in a car, one of the things that you can definitely say about New Garden and how good they are is, to your earlier point, that they've got such a good package. There's a lot of cars out there that are just not in a package that's that good. And so regardless of what you want to do with it or whether you know what you should be doing with it or whatever, you're just stuck running low the entire way around the track because that's the only place the car works. Or you're stuck running the high line, or the only way for you to safely make it through the corner is like somewhere in between the two. And so you're, kind of straddling a seam or something. And so I guess I'm kind of willing to give a little bit of the benefit of the doubt to other drivers that are not in Penske cars, just on those grounds that a lot of times it you're just trying to like kind of look out for yourself. And it's not because you're screwing with the leader or you're trying to get in their way. You can just, your car's only working in one place on the track, and that just ends up being in the way of the guy that's behind you, or you're working your ass off to like figure out where you can run to be a little, to have the car just feel a little safer, basically to just get home, basically, when it comes down to it. So I would just say that I think that's definitely something that is going on once you're past halfway through a stint for half of the field. And then as the further you get through the stint, it's happening more and more to more drivers. I can, without question, appreciate Joseph's frustration, but I also just kind of think altogether, this is not something new or out of the ordinary for what IndyCar racing is, how it's officiated, how the rules are written. And so, I can get being frustrated about it unquestionably, but I didn't see anything that seemed deliberate or ridiculous, I guess, in terms of what was going on. I mean, even you mentioned Kirkwood's, and he was just somebody that they did show a couple of times, the incident between he and Grosjean in particular, in race two, where he just sort of, didn't take away the bottom lane completely, but basically just like drove down on Romain through the middle of one and two. And it's kind of like, all right, that is, I think Hinch used the word naughty on the broadcast. That was a good word for it. That was kind of what I was thinking. Like, yeah, you're not really supposed to do that. And the fact that it was a teammate is it makes it a little extra sketchy. I thought it was funny that he did, when he did come over there, I thought Hinch's comment was totally perfect. Like, why is he racing him so hard? Well, because it's a race, it's a motor race. that's exactly how I felt watching. I was like, because it's a race and like you guys are racing for position. Like, why would he not be racing you that hard? Like, this is not, fuel save mode in the third stint at Indianapolis, just trying to get to hit your number or something. This is like everybody's made their last pit stop and we're going to the end of the race or we're almost to our last pit stop and we're going to the end of the race. So I thought that was just like a funny exchange, but also I thought, shed a little light on or showcased just that you've got a lot of different things going on depending on how well your car is working and whatever over the course of this race. And I think that factors into the way the leaders are kind of coming up on people and dealing with them once they get there.
Totally agree. And Joseph, after the race, he said, after the second race, on Sunday, he said, I probably made too much of a stink about it. I was worried about the reverse happening and it getting worse, which is brilliant. Post-race thinking from Joseph there, that he was actually worried that he'd said too much and that he was worried about people were going to race him even harder or make it even more difficult for him. So that was a fun.
You just watch, right?
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right, JR, so getting into race two a little bit more. I guess this also was, in the same way as race one, was relatively simple once Joseph got to the front, but there were at least a few more kind of banana skins thrown in for him. He was at the front much quicker than he was in race one, but thrown a few obstacles, mainly a kind of late charge in Felix Rosenqvist just before the last caution. It looked at one point there where Felix might have had him or was pretty close and was coming in, and that would have been a real upset to see Felix take his first victory of the year and steal one away from Newgarden. As it happened on the last restart, Willpower was quite aggressive and didn't give Felix a whole lot of room. Also, Felix was really high on the track as well, so definitely a racing kind of incident, not Willpower's fault, but there was definitely Felix moving up the track there and was pushed quite wide, got in the marbles, and that allowed Alex Palou to basically come out of nowhere and steal a march. So I guess the general question here, JR, is do you think the Palou comeback has saved his season? Because he was eighth in the first race and he was really, after that race, he was really annoyed. He felt like his car was faster than that and that, he was kind of as annoyed as Alex Palou gets anyway. He wasn't annoyed at all. He was Alex Palou, but he was mildly frustrated, let's say, that the car was as fast as it was and he didn't have a better result to show for it. And then in Sunday's race, he felt like the car was really bad, especially in the second stint. On the broadcast, he'd criticised the tyres and said that his car had swung from understeer to like almost uncontrollable oversteer in that second stint on that set of tyres. And it was clear he paid his team a lot of credit, more so than usual, at the end of the race for the work that they'd done in all of the pit stops to try and boost him back into a position where he could fight. And he was he'd obviously worked himself into a position where he managed to stay on the lead lap, and that made a big difference at the end, and was the last car on the lead lap, passed a few cars there and did a great job to take a podium. So I guess the point swing there, JR, was the lead was as small as 67 during the race, but it's pushed back out to 80. So Newgarden still, I think, needs to outscore Alex by 12 points per race for the rest of the season. So I definitely feel like that podium was definitely a key moment in the season, and kind of proof that Alex is improving on these short ovals and doing his very best to bring his performance level up.
Yeah, I guess I think the general question here, like, do I think it saved his season? I don't think it saved his season because he's still got a huge lead. So I think anything could have happened, basically, particularly if it only happened in one of these races, and it wouldn't have been that big of a deal. But that being said, it definitely made it so that, you know, there's just so few opportunities at this point to cut into that kind of lead. I mean, it makes it still feel sort of you know, unattainable basically to actually get there. And I'm sure that that's not how I'm sure that's not how his rivals, that's not how Joseph, I think probably in particular, looks at it. Like, I think he's just, we know him and we know how these guys are. Anybody, I think, who had just clawed back that much over one weekend, you'd come out of that feeling bolstered that, you know, you've got a shot at this basically, but that it at least showed a sort of chink in the Alex Palou armor, at least like there's somewhere that he's not going to be the best guy. And it's interesting that it would have been interesting to see how Alex would have treated this type of weekend or going to short ovals where he sort of, they do just seem a little bit like the types of tracks that we sort of haven't seen him really excel at. He's been competitive at them, you know, but my feeling has been he just hasn't had a need maybe to treat them with the kind of intensity that he does at other places where he knows what that's going to give him. That's just a total guess, but it sort of feels like he probably came into this weekend with them, and he said in various kind of press conferences or sound bites over the weekend and beforehand that he didn't have the expectation of winning either of these races, really, that he was going to be happy with coming home with a couple of top fives or top tens or whatever, that he was just trying to, you know, make sure that everything kind of stayed intact. So, but I guess I my only point there is that it would be interesting to see how he would do at these places, and would it be any different than what we ended up seeing if he really felt like they were events that mattered a lot? If this was the last race of the year, you know, and he had somebody, whoever was going to win was going to win the championship. I'd like to see Alex Palou have to do that at a short oval, just because sort of wonder what his ceiling is. You know, he seems like a kind of guy that, you know, there are elements of Will Power's like qualifying performances and the way that he manages to just really lock in every once in a while that the only other driver that I feel like, just based on kind of the vibe you get being around them sometimes, that might be able to replicate that is Alex Palou, to just like pull something out with maximum commitment kind of out of nowhere. Alex just seems like he's got that in him. So, you know, we haven't really seen that at these kinds of places. I'm sure to see him end up on the podium was such a gut punch for Joseph. Like, yeah, damn it. You know, like he was nowhere. He was getting ready to lap him several times over the course of the race, you know? And so that definitely, he wouldn't have loved seeing that in the outcome. But I also want to just mention something that I thought was interesting, you know, with Newgarden. You just mentioned, you know, Felix and Will getting that great restart at the end. But the previous, when Felix was really right on Joseph, and this happened at one point with McLaughlin also, I think it was, they were all earlier in tire stints. So it was like coming out of cautions that everybody basically, you know, had pitted for tires. And so everybody was fresh. And I just think it's a little insight into maybe what makes Joseph so good here over the long distance, and particularly once the tires get old too, is there's a part of why he's so good over the duration of a stint and just over the race and so good through traffic and all of that, that I think is a little bit of maybe why he's not quite as good as Will in qualifying, and why he's not, you know, where he seems at least a little vulnerable for like a lap and a half at least, which is not saying much, but there's a little bit of vulnerability there right after, you know, a restart where everybody's on fresh tires, that it's kind of that he just has this, it's almost like there's a little bit of built-in pullback from being totally committed to one thing or another in terms of what the car is doing. And I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing to see, that it wasn't until you got into a mode where you really had to feel the car and see what you were going to, and see where it was going to work and see what you were going to get out of it, and started to have to think about, you know, being in Dirty Air or whatever, that once you got to that phase of a stint, Joseph was just like gone, kind of. But it's something that I'd be interested to get his like his feedback on, because you could tell even after qualifying that he was kind of annoyed, that he like annoyed with himself, basically, that he just kind of couldn't. He's like, I've never really qualified. I don't think he's ever been on the pole here. And you can tell that that sort of bothers him a little bit. But I think it's, I don't think him being so dominant in race trim and him not being a locked in pole winner here, I think there's a little bit of a connection between those two.
Interesting.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Another interesting kind of aspect of the whole thing is that Newgarden's now tied Pelot for four wins. So they're both on four wins, but there's an 80-point gap between them. So I just find that absolutely fascinating that two drivers could be on four wins in an IndyCar Series season and there'd be 80 points between the two of them. It's just it's a staggering number. And also I guess Pelot is kind of the outlier a little bit, but if you include the Sato and Armstrong car, if you kind of average results across the drivers and then average by number of cars, Penske have actually moved ahead in terms of their average finish after the Iowa weekend. And I think Scott McLaughlin and Will Power, obviously, both scored a second and a fifth each, played a big part in boosting those numbers. But I also, I think we've kind of touched on this on the pod a little bit, but I think Pelot obviously has performed incredibly. And I think Penske's kind of struggle for a pole over the course of the season has maybe kind of masked their performance a little bit and maybe made people think that they've not been quite as good as they actually have been. And don't get me wrong, they've maybe not been the dominant team Penske that you kind of expect or have seen in the past. But I think the level of consistency that those three drivers have been able to bring to the table, we definitely touched on this in the top 10, didn't we, in the mid-season rankings. Go back and check that out and have a listen, see if you agree with our rankings. But I think a big part of that were we were really impressed by how kind of close together the Penske drivers were before this weekend anyway, and how Newgarden's added two wins to the order there. I think just wanted to try and pick out some other stories. I guess the race two, I was trying to think about incidents and like significant things that had happened. I guess one of the things that kind of went under the radar was Benjamin Pedersen got parked for not being up to speed, IndyCar deeming him not being up to speed in terms of his pace. So he'd been parked, and we also had Stingray Rob disqualified. That was after a pit stop where the wheel nut wasn't even on the wheel. It rolled away in the pit lane, but somehow Stingray had still got all the way back around the track to turn three when his wheel kind of came onto the track, which we have seen, quite recently with Conor Daly at the Indy 500, where he crashed into a wheel. But on a short oval where you're kind of committed to a corner and you're partway through a stint where the tyres are going off, you were mentioning earlier, JR, how difficult it is for people just to stay on track at that point. Never mind, you can't just swerve on a banked oval when you've committed to a corner and your tires aren't your tires aren't fresh and you're trying to avoid a 20 kilogram object. I guess from a driver's point of view, that's like one of the worst case scenarios to see that happen, and it's understandable that IndyCar took a kind of no nonsense approach to that whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, and I kind of wish I had a little more insight into what was going on there. Like, it seems absurd that they wouldn't have just told him to immediately stop, like in the pit lane somewhere. But you have to figure that they didn't if he kept driving around. Yeah, I mean, that's just that occurring when just everybody knows that that's what has happened, just is totally unacceptable. So that didn't surprise me that that happened. I was wondering what happened with Benjamin. So that answers, I guess, my question about what was going on there. Yeah, this is definitely a place. These are the types of tracks that if you're, you know, the closing rate in the corner becomes that dramatic and cars are going off that badly, yeah, you're going to have some of that, you know, new tires to old tires at different points during the race. But, you know, if it's that dramatic that quickly, then, you know, unfortunately, you're just kind of at risk for it. I was surprised the Voigt cars weren't a little better just with Mike being there. And, but it's also just a tough weekend to get everything dialed in. So I can appreciate the challenge basically of showing up here and having to sort it all out that quick. I mean, to your point, I was shocked that nobody hit that wheel, not even clipped it or something. There were so many cars that it was right in the way of, and they were really late throwing the yellow. You know, the main concern now that we've got the aero screen is that you just put that thing up in the grandstands basically. So, we can definitely be extremely glad that that didn't happen. But I think, you know, I guess I would say to your first point, just about the sort of lack of incidents, I was impressed by that. Watching both races, you kind of, especially it's like the longer it goes green, as they talked about frequently on the broadcast, the worse the marble buildup, the rubber buildup offline gets. So to have only had a couple of incidents basically on those grounds and nothing that was that bad, part of that speaks to you're just having, it's same thing when you watch like Laguna or the old Laguna, I guess now it's repaved. So we'll get a different version of this, but road course tracks where the degradation is really high, sometimes you see fewer accidents basically just because everybody's having to be so careful. But at a place like this, when you've got that much traffic and cars running different lanes and, you know, all that kind of stuff, it doesn't take much to end up just kind of drifting up the road and bumping into the guy next to you or whatever. So I guess that's really just a shout out to the quality of the drivers and their decision making and spotters and everybody else out there in the IndyCar series, that we don't see more of that. Because this is the type of race that you can imagine this race occurring with a ton of caution, because a lot of little things just don't go quite right because they're going so fast in such close quarters for the entire race. So, you know, that's, I mean, I had a number of people texting me, just friends or whatever, you know, saying, man, I forget how good the racing is at Iowa until it shows up on the calendar and we're watching the race every year. So I think that's definitely worth mentioning, that just, you know, the casual sort of casual race fan gets some appreciation for IndyCar out of this event.
Yeah, for sure. And so many of the things they're doing at Iowa now are, you know, so good in terms of what promoters should be doing for a short oval track. And obviously a lot of it comes down to getting the right sponsor and having the right backing to be able to do those kind of things. But Hy-Vee have really taken this event and made it their own, and to have people like Ed Sheeran and Carrie Underwood performing in concerts and stuff surrounding the event and all that kind of stuff really makes it a really you know, cool event for fans to be at, and kind of gives the whole event a place on the calendar, which is cool. So yeah, I agree with everything you said there. I guess I was just trying to kind of maybe paint a picture of, you know, why, you know, if you don't watch IndyCar so much, why you maybe thought Stingray Rob being disqualified was like an overly harsh thing. But just given how difficult it is to avoid, you know, a tire like that at such speed, and the aero screen element that you mentioned, obviously we saw Kyle Kirkwood's wheel go flying between two grandstands at the Indy 500 earlier this year. which is something that's kind of come up in the news as well recently, which we didn't get to talk about in the last pod. I think it actually happened after the last pod, but there's some development going on with the wheel hubs there that IndyCar have introduced to try and avoid that incident happening, and a lot of work going on behind the scenes there to try and learn from that crash. So that's an interesting aspect. We had Takuma Sato brush the wall, didn't we, and Agustin Canapino as well, and then he later had some reliability issues that kept him from staying in contention in the race. And then in the first race, we had Graham Rahal hit the wall in a car that he said was the worst he'd ever driven on an oval, which was quite an interesting quote from a driver who was bumped from the 500 earlier this year and has clearly been part of a team that have had some struggles on ovals. But saying that, Christian Lundgaard had a really good drive through the field in race two to finish 13th on his birthday, which I'm sure he'll be very happy about. He got to meet Ed Sheeran, and he also got a Lego Eiffel Tower from Hy-Vee, which was top of his birthday list. So that was quite cool to see that. And Hy-Vee had wrapped it in his wrapping paper with his car on, which was super sweet as well. That in itself was quite an interesting story, because after winning at Toronto, Christian had begged for the team to keep the car green in some way, because his car in Toronto had been green that he'd won with, and the car that he was scheduled to drive in Iowa was the usual kind of black and red Hy-Vee livery. So the reason why it was white and green was because Christian had campaigned to have some green on his car. But I wanted to talk about him, JR, and Callum Ilott to a certain extent as well. Callum was 15th and 14th in the two races. Christian struggled in the first race. He was 20th, but brought that back to 13th. But both those guys, sophomore IndyCar drivers in their second seasons. And I think it's a little bit harder to some extent with Callum to kind of understand why he finishes where he finishes. There's still a lot of work to do behind the scenes there at Hunkos. They have strong races, but they have spells where they really struggle. I think the pit stops are the main kind of thing that they're inconsistent with, and can be a real problem for them. But obviously their stops were relatively good this weekend, and Callum just looked, he looked quick. Like, I know that's a bit of a oversimplification and a bit of a silly thing to say, but the thing I'm kind of getting at with both of these guys, especially in the second race there, was that they seem to have kind of got their head around ovals and in their second seasons. I guess I just wanted to kind of get a little bit of insight from you in terms of, I know you obviously came up racing ovals and road and street courses, so you obviously came into IndyCar with a bit more probably knowledge than these guys have in terms of the oval aspect of things anyway, but just your kind of insight in terms of how difficult it must be to try and get your head around an oval coming from Europe and not having that experience, and especially doing it in teams that are struggling maybe for direction and that need that help to be able to know where to go with the car, and just seeing them kind of perform pretty well this season on ovals.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing coming into the IndyCar series, whether you've had an oval experience or not, and we talked about this earlier for guys like Kirkwood and other drivers coming through Indy Lights right now, Indy Next now, is even those guys don't come into the IndyCar series with much oval experience, certainly relative to how it was when myself and Hinch and Charlie Kimball and, there's a whole, even Joseph and Connor and those kinds of guys, they weren't far behind us in terms of their sort of ascension into the IndyCar series. We still raced a lot of ovals back then. Now you just don't. So there really isn't somewhere that you can come from these days that you come into the IndyCar series with much oval experience, even if you wanted to prioritize that. The thing that, and this is certainly the case in my experience, I think when you think about Joseph and him being so good at a lot of these places, some of it is just you end up with like a knack for it. I mean, there's drivers, whether you talk about, Nigel Mansell, Juan Montoya, there are some of these guys over the course of history that have just gotten in a champ car, gotten in a kart car and hauled out. Greg Moore, there are drivers absolutely that you get it, you understand it, it makes sense to you, it's fast, it's interesting in a different way, and it just clicks, in terms of what you're looking for and kind of the vibe that you're getting from the race car and the track, and there's kind of like a whole feeling to it, showing up and racing on ovals that can kind of either be really into it or not, and that even plays a factor. But The other piece of it is, and this is, I guess, the initial point that I was going to make, is that if you, I mean, I was lucky, and I think Joseph was fortunate in this way, just to talk about the guy that's obviously like winning a lot of races right now, that I got into pretty good cars at various different types of ovals fairly quickly. Like in racing for Panther Racing, okay, it was a one car team, and so there were some downsides to that, certainly showing up at other places, but they were good at a lot of oval tracks, had a lot of data. The car was, you know, hadn't changed much. So at least like I knew when I got in that car as a rookie that, you know, kind of two things. One, it was probably already pretty competitive. So that it reduces a little bit of the stress factor as a driver for having to like figure that out. And two, that the team was going to be very capable of taking my feedback and either helping me get what I needed or help me understand why what I thought I needed wasn't maybe what I needed. And there was like enough experience and kind of focus on the whole thing and, you know, just general knowledge about oval racing for that all to more or less make sense. And that didn't necessarily mean that everywhere we showed up, we were good. But what that ultimately ended up creating for was a situation where I got to feel when the car is really good on an oval, you do just know that kind of immediately. Like two laps into the first run, you feel that because it's just the way the car, you know, bends in. You can bend in with a lot of confidence and carves through the center without getting loose and, you know, pulls, accelerates off the exit of the corner, whether it's a big oval or short oval or whatever. Like if the car does that, it's just going to give you a feeling like, oh man, like, okay, this is what I need. And so I think that, you know, looking at those two, the two drivers that we're talking about here in particular, Callum and Christian, I don't know that there's ever any particular evidence to suggest that they're in that situation where they're being given equipment at any particular oval track that they're kind of able to react against in that way. I mean, they've got, Callum's in an even more difficult position because he doesn't come from that background, doesn't have kind of an innate feel for it or some kind of like built-in knowledge of what he's looking for. He's kind of translating, well, what's a car feel like when it's good on a road course to, you know, can I kind of create some of that same, you know, psychological or physical feeling here on an oval? Yes or no. Doesn't have a teammate last year nor this year with Augustine there to like really give any particular, even just to compare against in terms of do they seem really confident, like they know what they're looking for and that they're getting it somehow or not or whatever. So there's like the feedback loop is not great. And for Christian, you know, he's obviously got Graham Rahal there who has at times been very good at kind of all of these places. He's been good at Texas. He's been good at Indy. He's been good on the short ovals a little more sporadically over his career. Like he hasn't even managed to kind of string that together into just being a constant strength of his. And that's probably has nothing to do with him. That's just, but even within RLL that as a unit, Graham and that team kind of haven't managed to maintain consistently competitive sort of equipment and a program and setups and whatever at these places over a period of time. So I'm with you when you pick those guys out and you say they ended up 13th and 15th, just the fact that they're, you know, not completely falling apart over a weekend like this is definitely noteworthy because it's tough and you're immediately like on the back foot once you get into these races because you're just immediately in traffic and that never ends. So you kind of just don't, you know, the test day really is the only time that you have to maybe just be out there on track by yourself for like 10 laps without another car there to go play around with some things, you know? And so I think that I say all of that, I guess, because in the hopes that people watching this and looking at these guys and kind of wondering maybe why they're not as competitive or they're not more competitive, basically, regardless of kind of what you compare that to on the weekend like this, is just, it's hard. Like, it's hard to be in that position and kind of start to accumulate all of the personal knowledge, like the things that you need to know, the things that you need to then be able to actually do, like actionably, you know, kind of put into place in your approach and your attack of the track and qualifying and race and these various kind of different situations that all need sort of various different mindsets. And I think the flip side to that is you look at like McLaughlin and been here for the same amount of time. But been in a Penske car the whole time, and he has Joseph Newgarden and Will Power as your teammates. Like, you just think about how different that, because of both of those things combined, both that he's in a really good car that is really good at all these places, and that he just, you kind of get to double down on that and really know how good that car is and what it's capable of by having those guys as your teammates. That's just a much sort of steeper incline in terms of your learning curve. And I think Scott's really good too, but he's just in a position that he is going to figure this out way quicker than Callum or Christian is, because he's got those things working to his advantage.
Yeah, the good points you raise as well. And even with Christian at Rahal, I know they've got Graham Rahal there, and Jack Harvey's got some experience now, and there's a lot of people behind the scenes there, but it must be difficult to be him in a team where they've struggled so much, even though they have all of that information. And I guess another reason to kind of point out, you know, Callum and Christian is because, like, looking at your old team, Ed Carpenter Racing, like, they had Ryan Hunter Way, who's a multiple winner at Iowa, and Ed Carpenter obviously only does the ovals, and that's his sole focus. And they were Hunter Way was 23rd and 24th, and Carpenter was 24th and 23rd. So I guess I only picked those out just to illustrate that you can have all the experience in the world and one of the kind of best oval teams in IndyCar, and you can still really, really struggle if you don't get your head around everything and you know, do all the things that we've already discussed that people like Joseph Newgarden are doing to make sure that they're competing at the front. All right, so there's a quick kind of thematic rundown of two races at Iowa. The podcast has gone as quick as the two races felt like they did over the course of that weekend. We have an off weekend now. I'll be heading back to the UK after a busy trip at Toronto and Iowa, and then heading back out for Nashville, which I'm very much looking forward to. It's my first trip to the street circuit there, and I hear it's had some interesting races in the past, so hopeful that it's going to throw up another interesting one. And a little bit of news broken by Marshall Pruitt over at Racer last week, that there's potential that Nashville will be the season decider next year, which will definitely throw a spanner in the works if the championship's gone down to the last round, although it will be on a slightly different altered kind of layout as the Tennessee Titans redo their stadium complex there. So that'll be an interesting thing to keep an eye on. We'll be back next week before Nashville with at least one special guest and potentially two special guests for our episode next week. We'll preview Nashville and we'll talk about some other topics with those people. It'll become clear what topics we talk about when you find out who those people are. But for now, that's all for this week's episode of the Race IndyCar Podcast.
The Athletic.